Accession number 28351, Real Ed.
This is very fascinating.
Is it not too wide of the mark?
To be there. No, not at all. No. It's all very interesting information from someone who was there, during that very interesting period. You were saying they're very peaceful people, the Cambodians.
They struck us as such.
Awful things happened, and Pol Pot must have had a lot of followers in order to have carried out his sort of campaigns and his rule.
He must have started with quite a lot.
Yes.
But not an enormous number, because he had the guns. Where he got the guns from, I don't know. I wasn't there at the time of Pol Pot. And it's clear to me, you see, from Saddam Hussein, other tyrants, and from Pol Pot, that if you've got a monopoly of the weapons, your people don't have any weapons, you can force them to do almost anything. And I dare say that a lot of the Cambodians who carried out atrocities didn't really enjoy doing so, but were forced to do so because otherwise they would have been shot themselves.
This brings in, the arms trade, doesn't it? And the importance of that to countries like Britain, and the morality of it as well. The way, despots have been armed by the Western countries.
Yes, I don't feel passionately about this because I think it's very limited what one can do. Because arms will be sold. Even if we stopped selling all arms abroad, other countries would do it. Things, I think, are very slowly getting better. We've got various treaties against the arms trade. We've got nuclear test ban treaties. We've got non-proliferation treaties, some of which are not observed very closely. But very slowly, things are moving in the right direction.
With conventional weapons as well, do you think?
There are treaties about conventional weapons, yes. People are more aware of the dangers of having too many conventional weapons in the world. But how you actually reduce the number, I don't know. I've never really taken a deep interest in this subject.
I suppose at the moment it's arms to rearming, arms permitted to China, isn't it? This seems to be a very big issue.
Yes.
At this present.
Yes, so whether we should revoke the embargo. I think we should accept the American view, because the United States is so important to us. And the United States does feel very deeply about arms to China, because it is fixed. It is obsessed by the importance of Taiwan. Ever since Mao Zedong took control of China and Chiang Kai-shek fled with his people to Taiwan, the Americans have been very much mixed up with Taiwan. Madam Chiang Kai-shek was a great figure in this. She was a great figure in Washington when Chiang Kai-shek went there. And there were two sisters. The surname of whom I can't now remember, but she was one of them.
Was it the Sun
family? Could well have been. It was a name like that. It wasn't that name. She made a big impression, and of course the Americans were obsessed by communism, therefore they were very anti-Mao Zedong, and they thought Taiwan was going to be a base for Chiang Kai-shek, possibly for a return to the mainland. That's what Chiang Kai-shek kept on saying. So I think the Americans have not been very clever about Taiwan. I think they should have been working for a unification. Well, we can't do that. I wouldn't recommend we did anything about that. More important for us to appear to the Americans to be on their side. And this is a subject which is very important in the Congress in Washington. There are members of the Congress who are passionately dedicated to supporting Taiwan, who really think that this has very great importance. And if Taiwan fell, it would be a step towards worse things happening. I don't believe that's the case. But this is not a very popular view, I think. I don't know what the view of the Foreign Office is now, but I think that they're advising the government, you can, with the other European countries, France and Germany, you can afford to lift the embargo. I don't think the benefit from doing that would equal the damage done to our relations with America.
During your early time in the Foreign Office, you know, this is 1953, quite soon after the war, and when the Cold War was really, really very dangerous, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it was.
You have indicated by several of your statements that this relationship with America and having the troops committed to Europe was absolutely central to British foreign policy. Do you think that has been the same right through the years to the present day, and perhaps explains why Tony Blair has been such a staunch supporter of George Bush? Has it always been the linchpin of British foreign policy?
Yes, in my time. I'm sure Tony Blair was influenced in what he did about Iraq by his view, which I think would have been the view of the Foreign Service, I guess. I'm not in touch with them nowadays for obvious reasons. I'm in the opposition. But his view was that the most important thing is to preserve American connections with Europe and American defense. We must be on the side of the Americans. See, one has, if one looks at the history books, one has the history of Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, in the 1920s. When he didn't carry the Congress with him. And they pulled out of the, or they never joined the League of Nations, which he himself had proposed. So that was a very big lesson. And if the Americans had still been in the game through the 20s and 30s, I think the Second World War probably would not have happened. But the Americans had withdrawn. And that would be a danger if it happened again. I don't think it will happen again, because America now is everywhere. But this, I think, is Blair's motivation. And I support that attitude. I think the mistake Blair has made vis-à-vis the Americans is not to exert as much pressure or influence as he could have. I think Bush needed him badly. And Blair didn't realize how badly he was needed. That's my suspicion. He could have restrained Bush more. He could have insisted on better preparation for the after-war period, for example. We have a good knowledge of those countries. We invented Iraq, didn't we, in the 1920s. So we know it very well. We've got very substantial numbers of real Arab experts. So I think Blair would have had the knowledge or the advice available to him. But I think he was too cautious vis-à-vis Bush.
Do you yourself think that it's an advantage for a prime minister or politicians, you know, in high places regarding foreign affairs, to have had some experience of conflict themselves, direct experience? People like, say, Macmillan, and some of the other, even Winston Churchill, other politicians, that perhaps they take a more cautious view of war. Your own, you know, you're a very good example of this.
That's an interesting thought. Yes, I haven't looked at it that way, really. But it does, of course, you've been involved in war and seen all the horrors of war. You are more keen not to be involved in another one, which doesn't mean you become pacifist, as we've been saying. In Macmillan's case, Churchill's case, and so on, the Roman maxim was, though they may not have formulated it in this way, was very strong in their thought.
So after Cambodia, is this where you became very much involved with nuclear and negotiations? And I wondered, this is quite a big issue, whether you would like to go into that today, or whether, you know, I'm really with you, how you feel. This is quite a big issue to start.
Yes. The next thing was Canada.
Oh, right.
We went from Cambodia to Canada, where we spent 3 years. And that was quite different from Cambodia and quite different from what came afterwards. It was a lovely place to be, Ottawa, a small city at that time, but very congenial, especially if you had a young child, as we did. Our first child was born on Canada Day, 1st of July, just after we got there in 1957. It was very agreeable. I had a wide range of duties concerned with foreign affairs. I was the only foreign office man in what was basically a Commonwealth office at that time. Though there were, for a short time, I overlapped with another foreign office man. But basically the foreign office just had one man in the High Commission in Ottawa. So I was dealing with foreign affairs, largely, but with Canadian domestic affairs, because I knew Canada having been in the Canadian Army in 2 years at the University of Toronto. And I could speak French by that time. So I used to go, I was much concerned with the Quebec problem. And I used to go on a visit to the province of Quebec once a year on speaking tours to the equivalent of the Rotary Clubs.
What was the Quebec problem?
The Quebec problem, it was very acute, as it still is now. I used to, just before I get to the main point I want to make, I used to go and talk in these remote parts. I used to talk in Montreal and Quebec, where everything was understandable because their French was the same French as my French. But if you went into the remoter parts of Quebec province, I found it very difficult to understand the French they were talking, because this was the French of the 18th century. Because after the Battle of the Heights of Abraham, 1759, the leading figures, the governing class in Quebec province, went back to France, mostly, leaving very few in Quebec. And the church took over. And the church was frightened of being overwhelmed, the Catholic Church, being overwhelmed by all the English speakers and the Protestants who were coming up from America and so on. Although that didn't happen until 1776. With the Loyalists who came up from the eastern part of the United States, increasing the number of English speakers in Canada. And so the Catholic Church became very defensive and erected barriers so far as it could against contamination of the French speakers by the English speakers. And that, of course, was aggravated by the French Revolution, 1789. And the French Revolution was even worse from the point of view of the Catholic Church, because it was an anti-church revolution. An anti-religious revolution. And so the importation of books from France into Quebec province was banned until the 20th century. Extraordinary. Voltaire and so on, they thought was an absolute villain. So that was interesting. And I was asked before I left Canada to write a paper for my master, the High Commissioner, about the future relations between French Canada and English-speaking Canada. And I got it quite wrong, because I took the view that after the death of the, what I call in inverted commas, the dictator of Quebec, Duplessis, died not long before I left Canada in early 1960. He'd been the dictator of Quebec province for 20 years. Ruled it with an iron hand. And I used to go every year to a conference north of Montreal of the academics, the French-speaking academics and politicians and so on, including Trudeau and Levesque and other people who subsequently became, Trudeau became Prime Minister, as you know. Levesque almost became Prime Minister of Canada, I think he never quite made it, but he became the leader of Quebec province. And we used to have these conferences every year, these agreeable surroundings, and the last conference I attended had been preceded by a few weeks by the death of this dictator Duplessis. And this conference was to be broadcast across Canada on the Canadian broadcasting system, French language, to Quebec province and to French-speaking areas in Western Canada, as in some parts of Saskatchewan and Alberta. And for the purpose of broadcasting, a metal tower was erected outside the hotel in which the conference was to take place. And the night before the conference was to begin, the tower was struck by a storm and collapsed. And Du Plessis died by this time. So the next morning, when all the participants gathered, you could see these academics in little corners talking to themselves and saying, does the old man still have some influence? Quite extraordinary. So anyway, I forecast that after the death of Du Plessis, the French Canadians will be more prepared and able to fraternize with English-speaking fellow citizens, and there would be an improvement in relations industrially, commercially, politically between the two language groups, which didn't happen at all. And I said that because of a failure to understand human nature well enough. Because human nature, as I realized as a result of making this mistake, means, or it is such, that if you have had a deep-seated grievance, and the reason for the grievance is removed, you don't necessarily get over the grievance. Indeed, you're able to express it more vigorously and openly, which is what happened. If I'd understood human nature a bit better, I might have got that right. As far as Canada
goes, until 1960.
Until 1960. There's one other thing I could say about our time in Canada. It was very bad for my diplomatic skills, because we agreed so much with the Canadian government that I didn't really have the sort of problem that one has in most embassies, which is how do you persuade the government to which you're accredited to accept Britain's point of view? Because the point of view of Canada on almost everything I was dealing with in Ottawa, where the government was seated, was just like ours. And so after a time, when I was dealing with an Indochina question, Indochina was still a very topical subject, if I got a telegram from London, from the Foreign Office, saying, this is our view on a certain subject, please discuss this with the Canadian government and attempt to persuade them to accept our view, I didn't sort of rehearse very carefully, as I would have done in Cambodia or some other posting, disarmament or something, very carefully what I was going to say so as to get it absolutely right and not to put a foot wrong and upset my interlocutor. I just put the telegram in my pocket and took it round to the head of the Southeast Asia Department and put it on his desk, and said, well, Paul, what are we going to do about this? I got a reprimand from the Foreign Office about that. But that was not good for one's diplomatic skills, because they got very rusty. So when I left after 3 years, it was time to go for my diplomatic abilities.
I think that's a good place to stop today, don't you?
Right.
And then we can negotiate for next time. So that would be the end of Real 8. Thank you.
Yes.